Channel Y, Channel Y, a South Asian Canadian channel.
Hi, this is Priyanka Chopra, and you're watching Channel Y.
The biggest South Asian media group, Y Media.
Y Media.
Y Media has newspaper, midweek, radio, South Asian Pulse.
Hi, I'm Amitabh Bachchan, and you're listening to South Asian Pulse.
Hi, this is Amir Khan, and you're listening to South Asian Pulse.
अब हर दिन सुने GTA का नंबर वन रेडियो स्टेशन FM 91.9 दोपहर 12 से शाम 6 बजे तक.
टेलीविजन. You are watching Channel Y.
Channel Y. You
are... Prime Minister, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Online, SouthAsianDaily.com, the biggest South Asian media group, Y Media.
This part of the program is brought to you by Midweek Newspaper, published every Tuesday.
Welcome to Channel Y. I'm your host, Yudhvir Jaiswal, and just like to welcome a very special guest today. He's been working with our former Prime Minister, Shrimati Indira Gandhi ji, former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi ji, and also has been advising a former Prime Minister, Dr. Manmohan Singh. Many of you must recall the day when we and he is also referred to as the father of the telecom. So there is lots that we are going to discuss in the next hour or so. So at this point, I'd like to welcome Sam Petroda. Sir, a very warm welcome on behalf of Y Media Group.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
You're very welcome. Sir, just for our viewers' benefit, if you could take us through the journey and in about a minute or two. So I know it's very difficult from a small village in Odisha, how you rose to those heights that, yes, you were able to work with prime ministers.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I was born and raised in a small little tribal village in Odisha. I was born in British Raj in 1942. There were no schools of any kind in that village. My parents were from Gujarat, who had come to Odisha looking for work. So they decided to send us to a boarding school for formal education in Gujarat. At the age of 9, along with my older brother, both of us went to Gujarat, studied for 5 years in Vallabh Vidyanagar, then went to Baroda, where I got my degree in physics, master's in physics, and one fine morning read in the newspaper that President Kennedy has decided to take man onto the moon. I was young, energetic, and excited about going to America. My older brother and my parents supported me. So I borrowed a little bit of money and took a boat from Mumbai to Karachi, to Aden, to Egypt, to Naples, and then Genoa. Took a train from Genoa to London, took a plane from London to New York, and a bus from New York to Chicago. And I came to Chicago 55 years ago and made Chicago my home. Went to university here, called my girlfriend from India, and got married in Chicago, started my family here, got a job, built a company, made a little bit of money, and became financially a little comfortable. Then I took my parents to see Taj Mahal in India and tried to call my wife from Delhi. This was 1980 and couldn't make a phone call. It was very difficult. So a little bit of arrogance and a lot of ignorance said, I'm going to fix this. Based on my understanding in the US, I was convinced that telecom and IT will transform the face of India. Remember, this was 1980. It was very difficult for people to think that telecom was important in India. they were all interested more in water, agriculture, rightfully so. But I didn't know any of that. I knew telecom. So I got an opportunity to make a presentation to Mrs. Indira Gandhi. Then we had 2 million telephones. Today, we have 1.2 billion phones. India is a nation of connected billion. In addition, we generate a couple of $100 billion worth of software export and services. So telecom and IT really had a huge impact on India in the last 20, 25 years. What we started then was a journey to build human capacity, indigenous development, local industry, infrastructure, institutions. On one hand, we worked on telecom. On the other hand, we worked on supercomputers and all of that. We also worked on technology missions related to water, literacy, immunization, edible oil, milk production. And then Rajiv Gandhi provided all his will to transform India. I worked with him very closely, went back to India, changed my nationality. And then Rajiv Gandhi died. I ran out of money and I decided to come back to US. Then I worked on building a bank in London to privatize telecom in developing world. Finally, when Dr. Manmohan Singh became prime minister, I once again decided to go back to work on so-called unfinished agenda. So I focused on knowledge as chairman of the National Knowledge Commission, innovations, and Digital India. Once again, after 10 years, Congress lost the governor elections, and I decided to come back to US again to work on building some high-tech companies, writing. And during Corona crisis, I was locked up in self-quarantine at home for almost 14 months. And I decided to write a book on redesigning the world. So that's a brief sort of 5-minute journey. It has been an exciting, romantic, challenging adventure. I've learned a lot. I'm thankful to the people of India who gave me the opportunity. Thankful to Congress Party, Rajiv Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, Dr. Manmohan Singh for their full political will and support, and the talent of the young Indian engineers and scientists who helped me implement some of the ideas we had. So I would say I've been very lucky to get support from everybody.
Today, we're going to talk about all these things. What an incredible journey, I must say, first of all. And as you mentioned, yes, Sam Patruda's new book, Redesigning the World, we'll talk about that as well, that how does he plan to redesign this world. But before I do that, you know, I know you're close to 80 years, but even if you would have been 150 years, my question to you would have been, how could you achieve so much in such little time? Because you're talking about redesigning the world. I want to learn from you how we can redesign our lives, first of all, to achieve so much, please.
Oh, I got lucky at times. I had a lot of support, love and affection from large number of people. And I believe that ignorance is a great asset. I didn't know enough about the fact that these things cannot be done. So I ventured into it. I took risk. You know, my highs have been very high and my lows have been very low. You know, I made millions, ran out of money, came to America a second time when I had lost my citizenship. So I had to come on a tourist visa, again rebuild my life, again made reasonable amount of money and had an opportunity to do something in India. So again, took a risk and went back. I had good support from my family, wife, children. And I come from a very poor family. My father had fourth grade education. I was the first one to graduate from college. So then when I came to America and finished my studies and started my work, immediately I started calling one by one all my family members to America. Because education empowered me. Education redefined me and my caste. I'm supposed to be a son of a carpenter. But as soon as I got educated, my caste was redefined. I became an engineer and scientist. Then it was important for me to not only take care of myself, but also take care of my brothers and sisters and cousins. So we have a huge family in the US. I have seven brothers and sisters in America. And I think that's a journey of a typical first generation immigrant in America. We never lost track of the fact that we came from poor family. We came from India. We were part of a very large joint family. We had to share, we had to care. And then I was brought up in a very Gandhian environment. Remember, those were the days in early 40s of independence movement. In 42, nobody knew that India would get independence in 47. So Gandhi and his ideas were embedded in family values, truth and absolute truth, trust, inclusion, diversity, democracy, freedom, love. All of these were not just words to us. We grew up with these principles to guide our journey. And I think that helped us. We didn't focus too much on optimizing financial capital. We worked on optimizing human capital. Then it was not important for me to have a lot of money, but it was important for me to make sure that all my brothers and sisters and cousins and nephews all get good education in America. So I think paradigm and parameters were very different for us. We valued human capital, freedom as the key. I strongly believe that my father, who had fourth grade education, would have never thought of sending his children to college and universities in British Raj. But when India got independence, I'm sure he felt empowered. He felt that, wow, now my children can also go and be equal to everybody else. And that's what freedom does. So I would say we were at the right time, in the right place, and had right support and right values. So I think Gandhian values helped us a lot, where we didn't think of just for us, me. It was not a me too culture. It was more of a us, as many people as could come. You know, in those days, some friend would write to me from India and said, look, I'm coming to study and I need $500. Okay, come in, no problem. We didn't have $500, but we somehow collected it and helped him. And a lot of us did that. It's not just me. That generation of people who came in 50s and 60s were to some extent pioneers. Then we had very few people in America. I remember Chicago had only 400 or 500 people of Indian origin in early 60s. Now we have 250,000 people. In late 60s, we couldn't get any grocery in India. From India in America. I remember first time when we got some basin, which was at Italian store. I remember that. And you know, we were so excited that you could make some pakoda. you could make some kadhi. It was the excitement of the lifetime then, because we haven't had that kind of food here. Now, Indian food is all packaged and perfect and available on street corner. So things have changed a lot in America as well. And we were witnessing those changes as we went along. Today in America, we have close to 4 million people of Indian origin. Indians wheel and deal in power. They control huge amount of financial assets. They are universities, they are in banks, they are in businesses, they are in politics, they are in filmmaking, you name it. And I think people of Indian origin have made name for themselves. Same in Canada. So I think we all have come a long way. But the most interesting thing to me is the connectivity. My journey is a journey of connectivity. When I was born, most of electronics was vacuum tube. Transistor was invented 5 years after I was born, in 1947. That really started communications and computer revolution. So I have seen it all. I've seen the birth of transistor, though I was very young. I've used vacuum tubes as a student. I built my first circuits using integrated circuits. I've seen birth of microprocessors, software, Apple, Microsoft, and all of that. And that journey, where phone was a luxury, to all the way now, where phone is a necessity. Phone is empowering. This is my new window to the world, okay? And that journey has been a very important journey for me. And I begin to see world through the potential of hyperconnectivity. Hyperconnectivity is the key to taking human civilization to the next level. And that, to me, is the most exciting part of the future.
Oh, mesmerizing to listen to you, and I didn't want to interrupt in between. And while reading your book, I'm sure I'll like to request to all our viewers, do take a chance to read the book, Redesigning the World, but we'll talk about that also. How do you plan to redesign the world? And the journey that you're talking about in 1942, much before India's independence. So two-part question. One part, if today, once again, you are the advisor to the current prime minister, let's not get into that debate. It's BJP's prime minister or Congress prime minister. We're not getting into that debate right now. But if today you are the advisor to the current prime minister in India, two questions for you. One question, that do you think India has progressed well in these 70 years and India is on the right track? Or you think, no, India is far behind? Or you think India is well ahead? That's the first part of the question. The second part is, you're talking about redesigning the world in your book. Just in case, you as an advisor of the prime minister, how would you redesign the future of India? Any points that you want to make, please?
Loaded question. It will require a lot of time, understanding, patience, and I may not have all the answers. So let's take a first question first. I would say we have come a long way as a nation. We must remember that at the time of independence, we were completely robbed. India was the largest economy in the world in 1764, 1765. Roughly 25-27% of the world economy was India. And similarly, China was also very large then. Just in 200 years, roughly, during British Raj, Indian economy went from 27% to 2%, 2.5%. India had lost a lot of confidence. Indian industries were essentially killed. We didn't even make razor blade to shave beard. So at independence, we had to spend a lot of time in building human capacity and a base. That's why Pandit Nehru's of the world started IITs and IIMs, to build human capacity to build a nation. You must remember that the IITs were built to train engineers to build bridges and dams in India. Then no one had any idea that IIT graduates will come to Silicon Valley and run basically Silicon Valley, or for that matter, you know, industries and offices in Singapore, or for that matter in Australia. They are all over. That turned out to be a human resource for the world. So India had to build from scratch everything. At the same time, we had a bigger task to build democracy. We had to focus on equality, inclusion, diversity. And I think India did very well. The fact that we are working, functioning democracy. See, people believe that democracy works only in rich countries like America. So it was the biggest experiment on the planet, with very large population and democracy. That experiment worked. We could hold people together with the diversity we have. I always give this example that when I was in Soviet Union during Gorbachev's time, one of the ministers said, "We love India." And he said, "You know, Mr. Petroda, the reason we love India is that you have been able to hold this country together without guns. The way we turn our guns around, the day we turn our guns around," he said, "perhaps we will collapse." And I didn't understand what he was saying then. But when Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, I realized the power of his statement, meaning of his statement. So I think India has achieved a great deal. Longevity has increased, infant mortality has decreased, education has improved. But we could have done a lot more. We still have poverty, hunger, ignorance, all of it is there. But remember, our population has quadrupled. Quadrupled, even more than that. And that has been the reason we don't see a lot of the prosperity that we think we have built. So I'm proud of what India has done. I'm proud of the fact that we all live together in peace and harmony. I'm proud of the fact that we build human capacity to be a significant player in the world. But I am not very proud of the fact that we still have 400 million people who are below poverty line. I am not proud of the fact that we don't have the kind of institutions and infrastructure to take care of health of the people. And you see what is going on today with corona crisis. So I am proud of some things. I am not proud of many things or something else. Second question is, what would I do? I have no advice for anybody. Who am I to give advice to the Prime Minister? At the end of the day, he's a Prime Minister of a country. People of India has elected him. So I don't have an advice, but I have thought as an independent thinker, as concerned citizen, as old experience may not be very wise, but a man with commitment to India, commitment to future. I believe India must focus first on democratic institutions. Democracy is the platform on which India functions. Whenever you try to break that democratic framework with dictatorial mindset, with one man rule, with centralization of power, you undermine India's potential. So if I was there, I would first focus on building our institutions, give them independence. So judiciary is independent, election commission is independent, scientific community is independent, universities are independent. To me, that is very, very important. And I would begin to decentralize everything. And say, don't come to Prime Minister for all the answers. Answers are at the ground level. I would focus on bottom-up development and not top-down development. I wouldn't build big plants and big universities and big, you know, manufacturing facilities. I would decentralize. I would focus on small and medium scale industries. I would focus on unorganized labor. I would really push development at district level. I would build 650 different entities, one in every district, which is independent, autonomous, which is empowered to solve their health problem, education problem, infrastructure problem, food problem. I would bring new technology to agriculture and empower our farmers. Then, beside making institutions independent, decentralized, small is beautiful focus, I would make sure that the civil society is brought in forefront. Today, our civil society has been basically killed. Non-government organizations have no role to play. They are questioned, they are harassed with income tax raids, and they are saying, where did you get your funding? Why is Canada or US funding you this, that? Oh, there must be a problem. Just empower them. There are millions and millions of good people who are trying to do work at local level. Of course, there may be 10%, 5%, 15% bad, but that's okay. Just empower your NGOs. So they go work with local people on education, health, employment, art, culture, industry, craft. And then I would focus on bringing scientific temper. I would tell people that taking bath in Ganga is not going to get rid of coronavirus. I'll tell people that you can postpone Kumbh Mela at this time. Please understand the science of coronavirus. I would not have elections and rallies. I would tell people the facts, and I would act accordingly to show that I also wear mask. I also don't interact with crowd. I would send them the right signal. But I'll tell them the truth. I would be humble. I would fold my hand and say, look, I made a mistake. I would be transparent. And I would invite everybody. Because India is a country of diversity. And I would tell all political parties that in this political crisis, in the health crisis, we need everybody. Coronavirus is not going to distinguish between Hindu and Muslim, North and South, East and West, BJP and Congress and other parties. Coronavirus is not distinguishing between rich and poor, urban, rural, young, old. We all have to fight this together. And you can only do that if you first respect people. So I would focus on inclusion. I would celebrate diversity. I would decentralize everything and let people be responsible for their local affairs. I would carry people with me. I would provide open, transparent, Gandhian leadership. I would request business people to join hands in solving bigger problems. I would focus on Indian model of development and not Western model of development. I will build human capacity, invite non-resident Indians to come, participate in expediting the process of modernization in India. I would focus on non-violence. At this time, I wouldn't build defense infrastructure for a while. I would focus on building health and human infrastructure. Negotiate with our neighbors, friendship. I would do lots of interesting things, but that would require you to think out of the box. That would require to have different kind of character, different inner strength, different commitment to values. I wouldn't promote my agenda. I would promote people's agenda. I wouldn't divide people. I would connect them. I would pay attention to Dalits. I would pay attention to women. I would pay attention to young people. I would create more jobs. I would become a real global player and not worry about my popularity. Because my popularity as a leader is connected with the popularity of our people. I would really work for India as a servant of the citizens. I would meet with the press once every month and openly discuss all the issues, get their ideas and input and advice. I would invite people to come help, participate, guide me, join me, teach me, because I know I'm just one individual. I don't have all the answers. I'm humanly not capable. Answers are with people on the ground, with domain experts. I listen to domain experts. I mean, in this corona crisis, I would set up a task force of domain experts and not have wisdom from Prime Minister. If I was a Prime Minister, I would say, look, I have no wisdom. Listen to our domain experts. My job is to support them, empower them, listen to them. They know coronavirus better than I do. So I would do lots of interesting things.
Right.
I would learn on the way. I'm sorry for a very long answer.
Yeah, actually, I was really enjoying all the discussion. You talked about quite a few points. One thing that has been alleged against the Congress, and you can clarify that. That yes, as much there has been allegation against BJP that yes, they promote communal violence, but again, the allegation against Congress is that yes, they also indulge themselves in minority appeasement. That's one part of the question. You can give your views on that. And the second part, please.
I'm not answering as a congressman or against BJP or for BJP or for Congress. I'm talking about as an individual. What would I do? I don't have any power, so I can't do anything anyway. So what difference does it make? So when I answered, I did not answer as a congressman. I'm answering as Sam Pitroda, concerned human being. So let's understand that my answer has nothing to do with BJP or Congress. Please, let's clarify that.
Thank you for clarifying that. And today we are not here to discuss talk with anybody as a congressperson or anybody. Today, I think, we should not blur those lines. I respect you as an individual and the kind of intellect that you have. That's why my previous question was there, that how could you achieve so much in just 79 years or 80 years? I think it's very difficult for anybody to achieve that much in 150 years. And you've been advising our former Prime Minister Srimati Indira Gandhi ji, Rajiv Gandhi ji, Dr. Manmohan Singh ji, and of course, you've been working closely with Sonia Gandhi ji and Rahul Gandhi ji as well. So I think that's why we're discussing all these things with you. And I created a hypothetical situation with you, as I cleared earlier that it has got nothing to do with BJP or Congress. But now I'm just asking you, even as an outsider, and I'm asking here to Sir Sam Pitroda, that we will discuss BJP, we will discuss Congress as an outsider. And being a journalist, yes, this is a journalist question to Sir Sam Petruda as an individual, as an intellectual, who I would want to ask that if you had to answer this question, does Congress allege in minority appeasement? This is the allegation. So now I'm just asking you, please.
I don't think so. Okay, I don't think so at all, because to me, the idea of India that founding fathers had, who formed the Congress Party, was based on inclusion, diversity, freedom. Those fundamentals are intact. Now, somebody may be misusing it. That's okay. I don't like that. But that doesn't change the value system. Value system, the idea of India, rooted in the independence movement, is still intact. Now you could say, oh, you did this and you did that. I'm not into tutu meme. I have no interest in it. I don't indulge in it. I look at future and horizon. I don't look at past. I don't have eyes in the back. I have eyes in the front. So what did they do? Why did they do it? I don't worry about it. Believe me. Nor am I here to justify anybody. I look beyond day-to-day challenges. If I'm going to think of a vision, if I'm going to think of the future, I got to have my eyes high up and not down. That's what I do. Now, you don't have to agree with it, but that's who I am. You know, we are all very different. We all have our own view of the world. And my view of the world may be very different from yours, which is okay, but I respect that. Okay. I agree to disagree with you. So I don't think the statement you made makes sense to me. Okay. But there may be an example here and there, and somebody may have done something which is okay. Nothing to do with, you know, the core values.
What could precisely be the reason? I'm asking you, I'm not saying that, yes, you are here to defend the Congress or anybody else, and you don't need to. As a matter of fact, let me clear that as well, that yes, for me, I would have done at least, 4 to 6 hours of discussion just on the technology aspect itself, because that is one thing we can all learn a lot from you. Actually, the entire world, not just me, not just Indians, but I think the entire world can learn a lot from you. And at this note, I'll also request that maybe we'll, in our future conversation, I'll definitely make that as part. But I want to get on to the redesigning the world very quickly. But before I do that, regarding Congress, where do you think that it lost the plot? Because such a grand old party, and now here we are with Congress with only around 6.
I don't think it has lost the plot. You know, I think everyone goes through up and down. That is part of the process in political environment. In America, you have a system where normally 8 years of Democrats, 8 years of Republicans. And in democracy, it is good to have different parties come to power at different times. I think it's good for the country. Okay. So people of India decided to elect a different government in 2014, which is okay, which is perfectly normal. It is the right of the people of India to do that. And you have to respect that right. And when people of India realize that it is the right time to bring Congress back to power, they will bring it back to power, or somebody else. So I don't think it's a matter of losing plot. It is the mood of the nation. And we have to respect that. That's all. Perfectly normal. Nothing to worry about. Look at the history of a nation. Don't look at history of a party. Don't look at history of an individual. Don't look at an event. Look at the process. The process is we are a democratic country. The process is that people elected non-Congress government. Power was transferred without any problem. Look at the beauty of that. People respect what they voted for, which is perfectly normal. When people will be convinced that this was a mistake, they'll do something else. Until then, they will continue, which is their right. We must respect that.
And when you say redesigning the word, so in this book you talk about a lot of things. So moving in the right direction. Why would you want to even redesign the world in the first place? Let's address that.
I believe that two recent events. One, the power of hyperconnectivity. And two, Corona crisis gives us unique opportunity to review, reflect, reassess and repurpose many of our institutions and infrastructure. When I started thinking about these things, I realized almost 5-7 years ago that the world was last designed during World War II, just about the time I was born. Just about 80 years ago. That design was led by US and few Western countries. And that design gave birth to UN, World Bank, IMF, NATO, WTO, WHO, GDP, GNP, per capita income, balance of payment, trade deficit, and created a rule-based system, which everybody follows even today. And to me, that's a great contribution to the world by America, that we have a rule-based order. Then world was bipolar. You had US on one side, and you had Soviet Union on the other side. US design was based on democracy, human rights, capitalism, consumption, and military. The opposite side was dictatorship, no human rights, socialist economy, controlled consumption, but definitely military. US design was important to rebuild Europe, Japan. Now in 80 years, lots of things have happened. First, decolonization. Right after the design was put in practice, India-led initiative by Mahatma Gandhi not only provided independence to India, but also decolonized the entire world. No one had thought that world will get decolonized in such a short period of time. Then came the rise of China. No one thought that China would rise in 2-3 decades to the heights China is today. Then came fall of Soviet Union, rise of technology. Transistor was born after the design was conceived. And then birth of transistor gave us hyperconnectivity. Hyperconnectivity is about democratization, decentralization, demonetization. It is about content, connectivity, context. And it is transforming everything. It is transforming our relationship, business, finance, governance, distribution, delivery, research. There is nothing that we do today that is not affected by hyperconnectivity. Then came with technology rise, inequality. Technology has created an environment very few people are very rich, and lots of people are still struggling to make ends meet. Along with this, we realize that on one hand, technology has improved quality of life. On the other hand, inequality has really created a lot of dissatisfaction with the people. Then came 9/11, which was a response to a unipolar world. And that changed America. America imploded. Started looking inside. And then came COVID-19, which basically tells me that everything is interconnected, interwoven, interrelated. What happens in one little part of the world can affect everybody. No one ever thought that one little virus could put world to halt. So it's important to realize that what happens in India affects the entire world. What happens in Africa affects America, Canada, China, India. There is nothing that is isolated today. All local events become global, and all global events have local effect. So in this highly interconnected, interdependent world, there are only two important issues to me. One, planet. Planet doesn't need people. People need planet. So we must first take care of our planet. And it's not just about global warming. It's about our birds, bees, animals, rivers, forests, mountains, jungles. All of that has to be really an integral part of our development. I always ask these questions. Whose property is Brazilian jungle? Is it just Brazilian? No, it's not. It's global heritage. If you cut those, it will change the global environment. Then the next thing is, if we take care of our planet, we must take care of our people. And there we must recognize that everybody has the right to be treated with decency, respect, dignity, irrespective of their race, religion, color, size, shape, wealth. So if we take care of these two things, we'll create a new world. And now with hyperconnectivity, it is possible to redesign the world. In last 80 years, we haven't created any one new global institution of any substance. How can the design last for 80 years? So I'm saying it's time to rethink through, propose a new world order, new way of moving forward, which is more focused on planet and people. See, today in this world, you have two visions. Your American vision, which is to continue on the path of the last design and make it more robust, focus on democracy, human rights, and all that. And you have a Chinese vision, which is based on newfound wealth in China. So they are promoting Belt and Road Initiative. But I'm saying you need a third vision of the world. You need a vision which is not based on command and control. Vision that is not based on strengthening one country, one idea. You need a vision which is based on networking of nations, which collectively focuses on human development, which focuses on climate control, better environment, which focuses on inclusion, human needs, conservation, sustainability, and nonviolence. We spend $2 trillion a year on building military infrastructure. Is it really necessary to do that anymore? It was okay when we were fighting for resources. Now, we live in an era of surplus. We can produce anything. We have to decide what is that we want to produce. So I think in this era of surplus, we can capture resources not by fighting, but by promoting business. So why spend that kind of resource in building machine tanks? And you don't need machine tanks anywhere. Now robots will do the war, will do the fighting. So everything has to change. And our paradigm has to change. And that was the reason for this book.
Redesigning the world. Yeah. So I'll once again request of yours to please have your copy and go through this book. Where do you see India? You just explained two vision, one the American vision and one the Chinese vision. And I'm sure as a concerned person, you must also be as at all. There it is. Redesign the world. If you could show that again, please. Yeah, I'll request of yours, redesign the world, a global call to action. Please have your copy. And it's by sir, none other than Sir Sam Petruda. And where do you see, what do you see as the future of India? There are many, this is the question I get too often on our radio talk shows, on our TV talk shows. You know, what is the future of India? Please.
India is one of the most fascinating countries in the world. Indian diversity is unique. People on East are very different from people on West, are very different from people on South, are very different from people on North. Multiple languages, different food, music, culture, dance, languages. You look at the richness of India. It's mind-boggling. In addition, India is a country of young people. Lot of ambition, lot of hope, tax heavy. So India has a very bright future. No question about it. But then the question is, how do you measure development? Is it about GDP or it is also about environment, human happiness? It is also about health. So don't measure India based on just GDP, that China is moving very fast and India is not moving that fast. That's not the measure. A poor man in India is probably much happier than many other parts of the world. That doesn't mean he should remain poor, don't get me wrong. But I think the family fabric in India is very strong. Community is well connected. Indian communities are much broader, come to help. And it's a unique network of people. Indian climate is such that you're outside and your outside interactions are unique. So I think India has done well. India will do well. India has very bright future. But don't look at India in terms of 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. Look at India in a long scale. India was a cradle of civilization. India has the best of the best universities in the world. India has had all kinds of invaders come in and assimilate. India is the only country where all kinds of people came and just stayed there. You know, Mughals came and British came and French came and everybody came. And India is really the melting pot of the world. People talk about US, but India was there before US was even conceived in the modern format. So I think India has very unique landscape, sound, smell, colors, conflicts are unique in India. There is no other place like India in the world. I tell many of my Western friends that you must go to India once because it will change you. And it will also change India. I remember when chairman of GE came to India for the first time, he wanted to meet Rajiv Gandhi. And Rajiv called me and said, Sam, why didn't you meet Jack Welch? So Jack and I had a meeting on trying to sell him software, and he was trying to sell engines. And I said to Jack, I said, Jack, coming to India will change GE forever. And it will also change India forever because GE is in India. So I think that's the beauty of India.
In today's world, you talk about a Gandhian principle and Gandhian philosophy. And here we are, the trolling on the Twitter and the social medias. It's very difficult for people to understand, you know, that we can respectfully agree to disagree. The freedom of speech has been a casualty. So what do you see? Are you looking at a world moving forward where nobody's ready to listen to each other's opinion, or you think things will calm down a bit?
I think I've written a lot about it in the book, as well as I have given a lot of sort of, you know, talks on this subject. See, the problem with social media today is twofold. One, the most important one is unauthorized behavior. And two, business model that is based on number of clicks. So the social media companies make money if there are more clicks. They want more clicks at any cost. If lies generate more clicks, they love lies. And if you are unauthorized, in other words, I can register on social media as cat and dog. I don't have to be registered as Sam Pitroda. I'm not identified with myself, but I have a virtual identity. Then I can say whatever I want to say because I'm not responsible. So if you, so let's say you have this program, immediately people will start making all kinds of comments. Oh, I don't like Sam Pitroda's hair, which is perfectly all right. But who is that person? He's not coming out in open. He's hiding behind that veil. Or some person who is not interested in Sam Pitroda would hire 100 people and say, start tweeting. And these 100 people will tweet. And you will see social media, oh my God, look at this. All these people are unhappy. No, that's not true. It is propaganda. So it depends on what you want to pay attention to. Truth always prevails. Lies last for a while. Lies don't drive human development. To some extent, it is also a knee-jerk reaction to new media. People spend millions of dollars to promote lies. Political parties do that. They will have 1,000 people on social media attacking. You look at, you know, typically I know everybody's after Rahul Gandhi. If he scratched people, he'll say, why did he scratch? He should have scratched on the left side and not on the right side. I mean, does it really matter? Do you really pay attention to that? You know, sometimes my children will call me and say, Dad, have you heard this tweet against you? I said, look, I don't even pay attention. There's no meaning to me. Okay. Because I can't be dragged into that low level of conversation. People use four-letter words on social media. People hate each other. I don't think they mean that. But some people get paid to do that, and to them it's work. So I think over a period of time, people will begin to understand what is real, what is unreal, what is true, what is lie. And that judgment will have to be made by each individual over a period of time.
Another,
go ahead.
Sorry. You can go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Yeah, another question is that, you know, the current, because you've written a lot about democracy also on this book, just a hypothetical suggestion. Say, for instance, if today the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, you know, he has to pick mainly people who've been elected as representatives. As much as I do understand the cabinet and the prime minister has to be reflection of those who have been elected, but he has Mr. S. Jayashankar and few others, Mr. Hardeep Singh Puri, he lost his election. Don't you think we need to have a system that, yes, which is definitely reflective of those who are elected, but then you have intellectuals like today, with due respect, that there are many very able and very nice and very good performing cabinet ministers with Narendra Modi ji. But of course, maybe in the area of finance, maybe in other fields, I would have brought in Dr. Manmohan Singh, that, sir, I need your advice. Mr. Mortek Singh Aluwalia ji, I need your advice. Not that you are right in front of you, Mr. Sam Patroda, I need your advice in this field. Maybe given them cabinet. I know that you didn't even charge money to the Indian government while you were serving the country. So all these intellectuals could have been brought on board and given cabinet ranks, and then they could have really spearheaded India's progress. What's your take on this one?
It's up to Prime Minister. I mean, are you willing to listen to others? Are you really control freak? Are you willing to take risk with different viewpoint? Because when you bring professionals, you definitely risk that professionals will have very strong opinion of their own. And you have to respect that. When Rajiv Gandhi was Prime Minister and I was working for him, and in all my jobs, I've never advised anybody. I did my job. You know, when you work for Prime Minister, you're not advising Prime Minister. You are doing your job. You don't go to Prime Minister and say, look, I have this advice for you. You may have a title as advisor to Prime Minister with a cabinet rank, but that doesn't mean you go in and say, Mr. Prime Minister, I have this advice for you. No, you do your work. But what it means is Prime Minister gives you freedom to do your work. Prime Minister does not micromanage. I remember in telecom, Rajiv Gandhi and I had some differences here and there. But no, he trusted me. He said, okay, you do it. You do the way you think what is right to do. I trust you. I back you up. I give you all the political will. Same thing with Dr. Manmohan Singh. It requires different personality. It requires somebody who builds trust, confidence. It requires democratic mindset. It's a different personality, a different way of dealing with situation. You know, I'll give you one example, and I'm sorry to give this example because I feel really uncomfortable. You know, when BJP government came to power, we had a National Innovation Council. And I went to the Prime Minister's office and I talked to his secretary and I said, look, please continue National Innovation Council. I don't have to be there. There are other capable people in the country. Find all 15 new ones. Abolish the old one, because according to you, it was set up by Congress Party, which is fine. But please continue that. The first thing they did is abolish National Innovation Council. Why? Because it requires independent thinkers. It requires people who think out of the box, suggest different ideas. And you got to accept it. You got to listen to it. You got to pay attention to it. Are you prepared to do that? If you're not, don't have it. Okay. So it all depends on where you come from, what you believe in, how you want to operate. Okay.
But even right now in the cabinet, there are few, like you have Ajit Doval, like you have Hardeep Singh Puri, you have S. Jayashankar. There are few of them who are, you know, not really from the political background, but yes, they are helping. Then my suggestion was only that yes, you could have a lot more of them who could really spearhead India's progress. And this wasn't done in the past as well. When it was...
Good idea.
Sorry, please go ahead. Yes.
No, I said, yes, good idea, and more people should do it. I think we do need more professionals in the government. But we also need, at the same time, institutional independence. We need civil society's participation. We need scientific mindset. All these are important issues. Okay? You can't have one and not have the other one. Okay? So the bottom line is these three pillars. You know, we have a group that we meet every Thursday morning for last 1 year and discuss about challenges in India. It's a group of about 50, 60 people. And we come to conclusion now, after a lot of conversation, that for India, it is important to increase participation of civil society. It is important to have scientific temper, scientific mindset, logic, rationality. And it is equally important to have autonomy of the institutions. And institution building is the key. We need bottom-up development and not top-down. So these are all critical issues.
To conclude, my last question would be, I wish we had more time, but maybe I'll request more time from you next time. My last question would be, is it possible for either one of you to cross the fence, if not politically? I'll give you an example. That yes, with due respect, again, what a waste of talent, you know, just in case we have another BJP government in 2024. And then we'll still have Dr. Manmohan Singh, Montek Singh Ahluwalia, and Sam Pitroda-ji outside the fence. And I think all these people can, and there are many others, you know, who can make very good contribution for India. But just because, yes, they were associated with Congress, I'm not sure whether the BJP government would be willing to accept them or not. So is there anything like that could happen in the future?
It is up to the leadership. Okay, the leader has to decide, do I want to invite people for input and ideas? You know, recently Dr. Manmohan Singh wrote a very nice letter to Prime Minister. I thought that letter was very good. I was disappointed that Prime Minister gave that letter to Health Minister to respond. And a two-page letter got big response from Health Minister pinpointing problems with Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's letter. It just tells you how you receive input. A letter from a former Prime Minister of India to the present Prime Minister of India should have been responded by the Prime Minister of India and not by his cabinet colleague. That says everything. There's no more need for conversation on that response. Then it depends on how you look at it. You know, somebody would say, oh, why should Prime Minister respond? Prime Minister give it to some doctor to respond. That's also okay. That's Prime Minister privilege. But then I make that judgment differently. I see that as an act which says, I'm not willing to listen. So what do we do? Then what good is the advice?
Time, and before I let you go, I'd like if you could highlight the book once again, Redesigning the World, and also just for viewers' benefit, if you'd like to tell us that where can we get this book from, please.
Thank you for again giving me this opportunity. Thank you for a very nice conversation we had. Like you said, we can have a longer conversation on technology, democracy, politics, social science, engineering, whatever I could do, I would be happy to do it. And regarding this book, as I showed you earlier, this is the book published in India by Penguin, but it is available all over the world now. It is available on Amazon and various other platforms, including Google. It is available in hard bound form in India. Abroad, it is available in paperback. The idea is to sell lots of books, so we have priced it at very low price, just at cost. I think it's about $8-$9 or something. And it's an interesting book. If you are interested in learning about how the world was designed, because a lot of people don't appreciate that we all operate based on the design which was conceived in 1940s. I think this book will give you very interesting understanding. It begins with design of the world during World War, seven tipping points, new design, and then takes five elements of new design and has a chapter on inclusion, one chapter on capitalism, basic human needs, consumption and conservation and sustainability, and non-violence. Then there is a big chapter on innovation. Innovation in health, innovation in education, innovation in work. And finally, book ends with a manifesto for a new design of the world. The idea is to begin a new conversation. Not that this book is going to solve world's problems. Not that this book is the answer to everything. Not that I have answers. But all I am saying is, hey, let's think about new design. Let's have a global conversation where people from Canada, US, Africa, India, China, everybody can say, hey, we need something different now. Because we are now matured as a human civilization where we don't have to take guns and fight with each other. We are all connected. We can all do business together. We can all travel to different parts of the world. World is very different. Technology has really liberated us in many ways. Can we create a new world where we experience new things? Because longevity is going to be increased substantially. You know, I'm 80 and I feel like I'm 30. Average young person today will probably live to be 120, 150 year old. Because technology will make sure that they'll fix all the troubles you have. But then you will get something like COVID again. So there'll be checks and balances. But the joy of living today is very special. We are indeed living in best of the best time in the history of mankind. And how do we make that more enjoyable for everybody? I mean, that's the book about. Thank you.
Sir, it's a pleasure having you. It's an honor. It's a privilege. And we wish you all the best and looking forward to having more conversations with you. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Hope it was useful. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Maybe you can cut and paste and do whatever has to be done.
No, okay. Thank you so much, sir. The player is awesome. We wish you all. Thank you.
When will you be showing this?
This will be next Saturday at 7 p.m. and then again next Sunday at 7 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, both days.
Please send me the link.
Sure. We will send you.
Please do send me. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
No, thank you, sir. Player, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think I mentioned a couple of times, you know, even if you'd been, instead of 80, you would have been 150 years, my question would have been, how could you achieve so much? And I'm looking forward to many such conversations with you, sir. Thank you.
I'm always available. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
You are watching Channel Y. Channel Y, a South Asian Canadian channel.
Hi, this is Priyanka Chopra and you are watching Channel Y.
The biggest South Asian media group, Y Media.
Y Media.
Y Media has newspaper, midweek, radio, South Asian Pulse.
Hi, I'm Amitabh Bachchan and you're listening to South Asian Pulse.
Hi, this is Amir Khan and you're listening to South Asian Pulse.
अब हर दिन सुने GTA का नंबर वन रेडियो स्टेशन FM 91.9 दोपहर 12 से शाम 6 बजे तक.
Television. You are watching Channel Y.
Channel Y. You...
Prime Minister, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Online, SouthAsianDaily.com, the biggest South Asian media group, Y Media.